Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, thank you for joining me on the Preacher Boys podcast. Mindy, can you please just introduce yourself and let people know a little bit about you?
I can. My name is Mindy. I come from parents who are unchurched, but they actually raised us in pretty much exclusively in the IFB movement. And so I was just a regular, I didn't come from like preacher kid background or anything, just a lay family.
So. Okay. Got it. And what was it, you said they were unchurched before, what was it that ended up prompting them to go to an IFB church?
My mom's home life was pretty, it would have been considered dysfunctional. Okay. And she said that she always knew that there was something more. And so she thought she would find that in church. And so even though she was really young, it was pretty much my mom who was more that push to get us in church and keep us in church. My siblings and I were raised as faithful churchgoers.
And would you say your initial kind of memories of church were pretty positive for the most part?
Younger memories were probably better. As I started growing up, my parents were country people and raised on farms and things. It's not always convenient for women to wear skirts and culottes and things.
Right.
So in the churches that pushed that heavily, there was a lot of pushback there that we were rebellious. And so we were definitely in the lower end of the caste system because we didn't adopt everything. So some of those external standards as they would have liked to have seen us do.
Sure. When's the first time you remember feeling some kind of like pushback where you identified like, oh, because we don't fit into their mold, we're getting some kind of heat from people in the church?
Probably when I started being a teenager, I started asking a lot of questions, and you can ask a couple of light questions and get away with it for a little bit, maybe half a dozen or so. And then after that point, especially if they start getting really heavy, like, how do we know God is good? Then it starts a mostly polite, you need to sit down and shut up.
Right.
And that's not your place. You need to be silent. You need to be, you just need to let go and let God. You need to just trust Jesus and love Jesus and not ask questions.
Sure.
So probably when I was a teenager is when I started asking more questions because things just weren't right. They weren't right in the home. They weren't right at church. I know we tried to talk about that a little bit, and because you would think that the church would help the disenfranchised and those that are being oppressed and things. Right. And so we were like, hey, things aren't right. And they're like, you're just not being submissive. You're just being rebellious. And that's why things are bad in the home. And that's why if you weren't in sin, then that wouldn't be happening. It threw it all back on us. And I'm like, I don't think so. That's not loving behavior. That's not, so that's probably when I started going, yeah, this isn't all good.
Right. Interesting. So so was that your initial response as a teenager? Was there ever a point at which you started buying into that kind of thinking, or that maybe it is something I'm doing that's causing this? Or
I tried. I really tried, because I don't like confrontation. I tend to be, if I don't have to be assertive, I would rather be passive.
I'm right there with you.
Okay, maybe I am exhibiting some rebellious attitudes, and I can, okay. Right. Yeah, maybe asking so many questions isn't maybe exhibiting a gentle and submissive spirit. I know I would try, but it just, like, things didn't end. And I know my mom tried. I really never saw her defy my dad. If my dad asked for something, she really did her best to make sure that it was done. And I just, that didn't make sense, that she's doing what he's telling her to do. And I remember when I was, I don't know, 16, 17, maybe, in that neighborhood, the church that we were in at the time, we moved a lot. My dad's job moved us every 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
So every time we moved, of course, we kind of got that honeymoon phase again, and then it started all over, which probably helped take it longer for it to go, yeah, I'm done. But I remember when I was like 16 or 17, the church that we were in at the time had it was a very small church. So all the girls and ladies, there were probably, if everyone was there, it may have been 8 of us there at the time, probably okay. Like 6 or 8 sure. of us there on a given night. And that included the pastor's wife, who was leading the study. And we went through the book, You Can Be the Wife of a Happy Husband.
Mm-hmm.
And in my personal opinion at the time, and I haven't really looked at it since then, I was pretty upset over it. The more I thought about it, the more I didn't like it. And it felt like to me that it basically advocated that you be a doormat, and like your husband can ask you to sin or do whatever, and you're just supposed to do that because he's your God-given authority, and you're just supposed to let God intervene. And if he doesn't, then you do what he says. And that was uncomfortable for me, because they preach so hard against like alcohol and drugs and bars and things like that. And it gave stories about these women who their husbands were telling them to go with them to a bar or whatever. And they were just supposed to do that. And I was like, really? If it's not okay, it's not okay.
So. Sure. So how did that make you feel as a teenage girl developing basically into womanhood and trying to figure out what you're, like every teenager, trying to figure out what your place in the world is? And then the information you're getting is to be a doormat, to be, for lack of a better word, submissive. And how did that make you feel? Did that make you angry? Did that depress you? What was the response to that?
It was very confusing, because there's this natural inclination that I have intrinsic value as a person, and I should be able to expect that someone will treat me with some honor and respect and cherish me as a person with feelings and value. And then on the other side of this, they're saying that because I'm a woman, I don't have value, that I'm just there to marry somebody who knows all the right answers and then have 3, 4, 5, 10 kids. And that is my value as a person, is then having these kids and bringing them up in church to perpetuate the cycle. And it was like a mixed message and a double standard. And it was probably the thing that I questioned the most as I was growing up. I'm like, I don't see how it sounds like a double standard to me. And they're like, no, it's not. But it clearly, there's not a lot of ways around it that it's, you can't tell me that I have enough value for God to send a son to die for me. And that's valuable. That makes me valuable, but yet I don't have any value as a person. I can't expect a man to treat me well if he wants to beat me every night and abuse me behind closed doors or in front of people and insult me and put me down in every which way, then that's okay. That's my place as a woman, and I should be okay with that. I should just submit and be sweet and be gentle. And
yeah. So where did this line of questioning end up taking you? What was the result of this kind of line of thinking? Because I don't think you stayed put and just sat there for the next couple of years.
I didn't. When I was 18, my dad took a job in the Kansas City metro area. And after going to several churches and looking for a church for, I think it was a year and a half, something like that, we ended up, and we had visited Tri-City Baptist Church in at the beginning of our church search, but it's huge. We had always lived in rural towns, so churches would be like 20, 30 people, maybe a couple hundred people. One of the first churches we went to, there was a wonderful pastor and his wife, and I don't know if they were just like one of those rare, like actual people that really love their people and really love God, of course it was an independent Baptist church, but I don't know if it was part of the IFB movement or it just had independent because it was independent. But that was probably one of the biggest factors of us getting into the IFB movement was that couple. And we still keep in contact with them and their family today. In fact, I invited him to my wedding and I was probably 7 or 8 when we were going there. But then when I turned 18-ish, 19, something like that, we moved to Kansas City and started attending Tri-City Baptist Church. And it was huge. It was like, at the time, I think it was running 900-ish people
right.
on a Sunday morning. And it was the culture shock. Anyway, we ended up going there and they, again, tried to push things and I asked questions that had no answers apparently.
Right.
But I was old enough to start working. Okay. And so I had a job so the line of work that I was in, I worked a lot of Sundays. And so it was semi-acceptable for me to miss because I was at work. So yeah. I started through that transitioning out of church, and kind of the further I got away from it, the more dissatisfied, the more, because it's like working with a con man, where like a shortchange artist, when they're there with you, they're like, they won't stop talking and they just keep telling you what to do. And you need to give me that. You need to give me that. You need to give me that. And they won't let you like just stop and think. You're like, if you would just be quiet for just a minute, I know something's not right here, but you won't stop talking long enough for me to think about it. And so yeah, you do that. And then like when they're gone, you're like, they just got away with $50. And so it was the same concept. Like I was in there. So they're like constantly like talking. I'm like, something's not right, but I can't put my finger on it. And you won't stop talking long enough for me to actually figure it out. So the more I was away, the more it's like, these things just these are inconsistent. It's what they're teaching is inconsistent. Because they hold the ace of if you leave, you will go to hell.
Right.
Forever. And so I wouldn't actually pull the trigger and formally leave.
Mm-hmm.
But then my sister ended up getting married and she got married, and they're at the church. And in that experience, a lot of people, because I'm older than her by a couple of years, and she was on the edge of, it's no longer okay to be single.
Right.
And I was long past that. And people were starting to say some really nasty things to me and about me, and for my benefit while I was in earshot. And she had seen that happen to me, and she was there. She was on that cusp where if she didn't get married, she was, that was going to be her. And so she ended up getting married, and there were some really hurtful things that were said, just cruel things that were said to me. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. I just can't. I was hurt so deeply. It was, the hurt was bigger than the fear of going to hell. So I left. I couldn't do it. And a couple months later, I tried to go to a different church, and I couldn't do it. I was out of church completely for anyway a year. I completely disassociated with all religion. I wouldn't read any Christian books. I wouldn't listen to any of their music. I didn't attend any services anywhere. I didn't associate with anybody. I did keep, after several months, I started listening to, I had an audio Bible, and I started listening to that. Some, that's the only kind of Christian thing that I did. And that was for a very long, that was probably about a year. And I ended up going in a completely different direction. I had a little bit of extra time. And so I'm like, I should learn something. I should do something and better myself. And so I started looking around for some, I've always found Hebrew fascinating, and I always wanted to learn it. But so I started calling around, and one of the local synagogues had an introduction to Judaism class. So they let me go to that. And so I kind of, that was like the first interaction with religion that I'd had for like, probably 2 years. But yeah.
Okay. Huh. So after having that, obviously, like, fairly negative experience within a culture that's very restrictive, and feeling like there really is no future outside of the one that they're laying out for you, what was it that kept you still drawn to the idea of religion? Obviously, or I guess spirituality is a better word, but because religion was probably not something you're interested in.
No.
But what was it that kept you drawn to like this kind of spiritual side of things?
I had a couple of experiences in my life, and I had separated God and the church.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, I can see that the place is bad, but I still believe that God is good. Mm. I can see that the church has let me down and people have let me down, but I really don't think that God has.
Right.
And that was a very difficult separation, but somebody tried to kill me. And so there was like a whole different, there was a whole thing there, and I'm like, okay. So.
Was someone from the church or just a different experience?
Yeah, it was totally unrelated. It was totally unrelated. It was just one of those things that
makes you think about things.
But the whole thing is because I felt like marriages were basically arranged in a lot of ways.
But for all intents and purposes.
For all intents and purposes, it was arranged. I had a list of guys that I could choose from that were okay.
Sure.
Nobody too high, nobody outside the church. There wasn't really a whole lot of people that were too low for me because I was pretty much at the bottom. And they wanted, there was no to it. They wanted my pastor or church leadership. A lot of times my church was small enough that the pastor was the closest other authority that I had, and my dad, and those two, if they didn't approve, like I couldn't get married. So everything had to be like approved by parents in order for us to get together, and which is basically the definition of an arranged marriage.
If they say no to everybody except the one they want, it's the same as them picking.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier like a caste system, and I've had other people that have referenced something like that. When you say that, what do you mean by that? And what would you say that looks like? And again, this isn't a formal thing, but I would say for all intents and purposes, there's definite boundaries and levels in a lot of these churches. So what did that look like in your experience? And did you see this in each of the churches that you went to?
Yes, it was pretty much a universal thing. And it pretty much consisted of the people at the top were pastors' kids, missionaries' kids, people who were presumed to be super spiritual because of their position. People
or their
who,
parents.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah, or their parents. People who, their parents ran well-respected ministries and things. Those kids were, like, top of the system. Unless, of course, they fell from grace by doing something, like, really, really...
really bad.
Yeah, flamboyantly, right. Ostentatiously bad.
Right.
And then there were, like, everybody who fell in line and toed the mark and things. Those people came next, and people who had been like church leadership, like your deacons and things like that, leadership positions under your pastoral staff, those kind of people came as a close second into that inner circle. And then obviously this is all from my perspective. And then you had the other people who fell in as how much they appear to be, to borrow the phrase that you use, bought in, for lack of a better term. So, because my family didn't submit as much, because what's the necessity of me wearing skirts all the time? That's
right.
It isn't, what I wear doesn't necessarily reflect who I am. I can be a lot more modest in a pair of jeans than I can in situations than I can be in dresses and skirts.
Sure.
Yeah. And then, so there's like all these people who follow part of the rules, not all pick and choose from the buffet. Right. And then there's all the people who are just nominally there. Yeah. That's kind of how it appeared to work to me.
So. And then also this kind of ties in, obviously, experience of like how women are treated and I guess positioned within the church. Why do you feel there's such a negative treatment or view of women within the Independent Baptist movement?
So, because I didn't experience the level of abuse that a lot of your guests have experienced. Mine was primarily emotional and mental, spiritual abuse, mostly mind stuff. So, but the thing about grooming someone to accept abuse is that you don't just groom them to accept a specific kind of abuse. You groom them to accept any form of abuse. So you could basically do with me, even though I wasn't really completely sold out, because of the mind control and things, you could pretty much do with me on a lot of levels, whatever you needed to. I was at a point where, because we went to the camps, we didn't go to the Christian school, which was one of the marks against us, which kept us lower, and we went to public school. So that was, but I was still like, if you have to be there, then you have to contradict everything that they're telling you, like right. Everything that they tell you in science is wrong. So and then because I don't like confrontation, I would rather, if it's possible, just, okay, that's not that bad. I can do that. I would rather just go along with things as long as it's not like egregious. And so I wasn't a fighter, so they could pretty much do whatever they wanted to with me. Mm. And I wasn't gonna make a lot of ruckus.
Yeah, I relate to that personality a lot. Like I was the same way. Like I'm it's Everybody's a weird hodgepodge of different characteristics and traits, but I think it might be easy to think, because I'm doing this, I'm a very like alpha fighter personality, and I'm not. Like, I hate confrontation. Like, I did sales for 2 months, and they told me to quit. They said, we can't fire you because you're a contractor, but you're just not good at pushing anything. Like, for me, if someone says I'm not interested, I say, okay, no big deal. Sorry to bother you. Like, I'll never talk to you again.
Have a great day.
But I also share the personality trait you talked about, where like I question everything. So I'm a big, like, I question everything someone tells me, I question. And so it makes for this really weird internal struggle where I don't want to cause problems or fight. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably the one that's wrong, but this doesn't make any sense. And that's where I get stuck, is I'll get stuck there thinking, this doesn't make sense, but they must know something I don't know. So I need to sit here and try to understand where they're coming from.
And I think that, I don't know how to say it, but there's a misjudgment that if you would prefer not to face confrontation, that you're weak. Hmm. Yeah. So I think that a lot of people will misjudge you and say, oh, you must be weak and easy to oppress because you don't like to stand up. Hmm. And so they think that because you don't like to, that you can't, or that you will never.
Right. Yeah. And I think also too, like, there's also what's hard to understand, and a lot of it is, I'm working through this stuff too, is what parts of that come from my experiences in that movement. Like, what part of me being worried about confrontation? Because, and I've seen other people reference it, oh, I'm always terrified of what people are thinking of me, or I'm always terrified people are judging me. I'm like, maybe 20 years of being judged a lot is going to do that. But yeah, but I also think too, and you mentioned this, but it falls in that grooming category. I think people who are trying to manipulate you, whether it's emotionally or in any other way, they move the goalposts of what's acceptable. Mm-hmm. Like you said, when you get some distance from it, you're like, oh, to judge me because they're Sunday morning, Sunday night, but I miss Wednesday night because of work. The fact that I feel so much vitriol toward me because of that is really weird, but they move the goalposts to a point where, like, any other 20-year-old is going to say, oh, that's crazy. But at that point, they have you so bought in. And that's even weird that they use that terminology, but they have you so bought in that there's really no other reaction aside from saying, oh, you guys must be right. I must be doing something wrong. I need to worry about being here, not hitting my my hours this week.
Yeah.
So it's a really weird way of thinking.
Yeah. And one of the things that really, another thing that really bothered me that I saw in the churches that we attended was that there was no room. Like, everybody was a cookie cutter and you had to fit in that shape. This is the only way that Christianity looks. And if you do it any other way, you're doing it wrong. If it doesn't look like this, you're just flat doing it wrong. Fix it. Or you're probably not even saved. And I found that, because I'm supposed to find God's will for my life individually, but yet I'm supposed to fit the cookie cutter. And those two things are inconsistent. I can't individually find my God's will and purpose for my life when it's exactly what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, it goes back, especially for, I think there's a little bit more flexibility for guys within the movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can at least choose to be like pastor, mm-hmm. missionary, this. I think with, and I don't remember what episode we talked about it, but there was, I had someone on and it was talking about, basically there's like a transfer of ownership for girls in the movement. There's that idea of, oh, I'm my parents, and then my parents signed me over to my husband, and then I'm my husband's. There's never a point, like, while you're in the home of your parents, while you're dating, you're your parents. And then once you get married, it all switches over. There's never a point at which you take full autonomy and get to choose, what does that look like for me? What is? And it's interesting to me because, like you said, there was a pastor's wife that taught a class that went over that kind of stuff. And what's crazy to me is that the indoctrination is so deep where, like, women are teaching this to women at this point, where it's not even men saying, stay in your place. They've programmed women to tell other women. It's a really, like when you really start thinking about it, it's shocking the kind of stuff you'll hear female quote unquote Bible teachers within that world say to young women. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
I think it's one of those things where, and I don't think that they're the only religious group that does this,
but
those that you'll take new converts and you'll have them teach the fundamentals of the faith to a less educated group, like children or whatever. And then because they're indoctrinating the children, because they're saying it and hearing it and studying for lesson preparation and things like that. So you're actually programming the teacher more than you are students.
That's interesting.
So, yeah. Because you have all of this flow going in and all of these, because repetition cements paths and habits. So if even though that way of thinking is contrary to the way that I would think as a rational and reasonable person, then they'll have me teach it to other people. So of course, as a single woman, I was never qualified to teach except for like small children.
Yeah. It's a fine line. And I don't know, and I haven't asked yet, but I don't know what your current beliefs are, or if you believe in a God still, or where you've landed on that. But for me, it's like, I still am in pretty much every way an Orthodox Christian. And it was a lot of searching, kicking down stuff that I'd been taught and trying to figure out like what was legit, what wasn't. But there is a very fine line in churches, and I see this about any religious group. There's a fine line between like teaching and indoctrination. And I think when you, like you said, when there is that repetition, when there is, we talk about Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, Saturday morning, then Christian school during the week, you can call that edification or discipleship or fill in the blank. But there's a very fine line between edification and brainwashing. Yes. And again, this is coming from somebody, I still believe many of the same things, but I didn't come to those conclusions by sitting there zeroing in on what materials were given to me. It's just like this show. I keep the show diverse and talk to people who are, I've had people on who are atheists, and I've had people on who are pastors. I've had people on from all different spectrums, and I'm not scared going into a conversation that they're going to rattle my belief system. Yeah. I think you have to go to conversations knowing that, hey, if the truth is there, and I think everybody, unless you're really talking to someone who's very postmodern, I think everybody believes there is some kind of objective truth. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of gray areas. And the more we talk, the more we're going to come closer to the truth. If we're both objectively looking, we have nothing to be afraid of. I'm not going to have somebody come on and say a lie and then research it and then still be convinced. It's you're going to get closer to whatever that truth is. But like you said, if you're in a situation where you don't have time to even process it, you're not coming to a conclusion. You're just repeating. You're repeating what you were told. I would get mad at people about drinking or about the version of the Bible or about fill in the blank, but I didn't know why the King James was the inspired word of God. I just knew that's what they told me every day of the week.
Yeah.
So, and there's my tangent.
And one of the clips that you played, it was one of the preachers in the movement that was preaching against women's liberation, and that, well, all these women want is the freedom to divorce their husband and wear what they want and do what they want. It's okay.
We can look at the history of this. When did this cultural practice start to change? I made a joke. It didn't change in the women's prayer band. It changed with women's liberation in the early 1900s. So, and what was women's liberation? I know women were oppressed. They couldn't vote. They couldn't do all of these things. And you can be upset at me for my attitude toward that. But if there were wrongs, women's liberation wasn't the way to correct it. Because what women's liberation did is take women out from underneath in the economy of the home, the authority of their husband. And it was an assault on the godly framework, the way society and society is built upon families. the way society works. It was rebellion against God's order. Okay? It was a rebellion against God's order and has developed now into a rebellion against God's design. Okay?
I believe that a woman who is being abused by her husband should have the right to leave that man. I don't think she should have to live in a place where she is putting herself and any children or anyone that's under her care in a position to be physically and mentally and whatever kind of harm that person wants to inflict upon them. I don't think that I absolutely believe that someone should have the freedom to leave that kind of relationship.
And the crazy part is the Bible agrees with that too.
Go figure.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And to be fair, I understand. So there's a lot of churches that teach about the permanence. It's the permanence view of marriage where no matter what, stay there. And I think there's examples in the Bible of that as well, where people stay in situations where, you know, their spouse isn't faithful, or they stay in a situation where they're being abused or things like that. But the Bible also gives them a clear option to leave. And I think it's been sloppy at best, the way that we've taught people. Because are there people who truly are trying to stay in a situation for the good of their kids or to mm-hmm. be a light? Or yes. And if that's the choice that they make, I think make sure they're safe, make sure their kids are safe. But I think it's very sloppy, and I think it is a problem when you get into, I'm going to use a word that's going to make people upset with me, but when you get into any patriarchal religious system and you take what men say and make that your guiding light, you're not factoring in what the experience is for women in the movement. And I look at this when I look at independent Baptists, when I look at Amish communities, when I look at Islamic religious culture, there's very little restriction on the men and a mm-hmm. lot of restriction on the women. And again, whether you want to, I just think you have to be very careful, especially as a male pastor, you have to be very careful taking very strong stances on topics like permanence when you don't know the experience of a woman who's being abused. And I've seen people go after, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but I've seen people go after even John Piper over this.
Who's the name?
Yeah, he's a very well-known pastor. He's outside of the IFB, but I have a lot of respect for Piper. My daughter's actually named Piper after John Piper. And so, like, love his stuff. But sometimes I think he's sloppy with that topic. But I just think I'm probably sloppy with that topic because I can't imagine from a female perspective. I can't picture it.
Yeah. And the thing is, a lot of people have talked about like the caste system from like male, female, children. Mm-hmm. But the thing about that is, it's true, but it's not quite true either. Because yeah, men are at the top and children are at the bottom, but it's only like temporarily mm-hmm. if they're male children. Like if they're female children, they're still going to
be at the bottom no matter where they go. Right?
Yeah. But so in essence, they've placed, and even at that, the woman is still there to serve the children and bring them up. So she's still beneath the children.
Right.
In most ways, except for she can exercise a little bit of, no, you can't do that. But aside from that, in station, she's actually beneath them.
Right. Yeah. And that's, again, I think that's where you have to have women in the conversation. You have to have conversations like this because, again, if you're sitting in a room and deciding what should a woman do in this situation, but you don't ever ask a woman, like, what would be helpful, it's not going to work. It's like a group of white guys trying to meet in a room and say, what would help ease racial tensions? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You have to have that mix. But I do want to talk about the women's role. And I'm actually, I think I can do this, but my mom actually wrote out a like the biblical bill of women's rights. So she says like things women are allowed to do. And it's pretty interesting. And this is straight out of Proverbs 31, 10 through 31. But my understanding, when you look at traditional views of marriage within fundamentalist culture, it usually means like barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. That's like the kind of terminology you always hear. Mm-hmm. But if you, so like, I'll just straight up read it. And she doesn't know I'm going to do this. So she might be mad that she got a call out on the podcast. I don't know. But Proverbs 10 says, who can find a virtuous woman? Her price is far above rubies. So she said, a woman has a right to her own worth and the worth is hers alone. Her value is based on her character, not her circumstances, family, or relationship status. And then 11 through 12, the heart of her husband does safely trust her so that she'll have no need of spoil. She'll do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She has a right to develop her trustworthiness and kindness. She has a right to choose how she treats others. She seeks wool and flax and worketh willingly. She's got to do the King James. I'm used to the ESV now. Willingly with her hands. So she has a right to work at a job or career of her own choosing. She's like merchant ship. She bringeth food from afar. She's got the right to choose the most economically and nutritionally sound way to provide the best food for her family. She rises while it's yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. So she has a right to run her household, organize schedules, plan menus, assign jobs, chores, and responsibilities. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she planted the vineyard. She has a right to her own property, develop that property as she sees fit, and reap the benefits of that property's equity. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengthens her arms. So she has a right to be physically strong and fit. She perceives that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth out not by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff. So she has a right to compete in the marketplace and put in time and effort to make a profit. She stretches out her hand to the poor. So she has a right to be charitable and generous. She's not afraid of the snow for her household. All of her household are clothed with scarlet. So she has a right to provide. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. So she can be fashionable. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. So she has a right to share her reputation with those she loves. She makes fine linen and sells it and delivers girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor her clothing. She has a right to prove her worth in the marketplace, to create her own vision and self-worth. And she has a right to prepare for the future. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. So she has a right to an education and to apply that education in her life. She has a right to speak. She has a right to prove her innate kindness to others. She looks well to the ways of her household and eats not the bread of idleness. So she has a right to care for her family and those who work for her. She has a right to be energetic. Her children arise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praiseth her. So she has a right to respect. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. So she has a right to obtain personal excellence. And then favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord shall be praised. She has a right to a personal relationship with God. And then the last one is give her the fruit of her hands and let her work her own works praise her in the gates. She has a right to a reputation of her own making. So it's just from that one small section, it's like, how do you sit there and interpret that as women are just to be silent in the corner and essentially like a grade level above the kids in their position? And I used to get in fights with my mom because growing up, what I would hear from leaders in the church was women are absolutely not supposed to be any of those things. And even leaving the IFB and leaning more into like reform theology, there's a lot of people who say women's roles are to run the house. And it's okay, but what does that mean? Like a guy's job is to run the house in a weird way too. There's, and it's just really interesting. And again, I think a lot of it comes from not the biblical side. I think it comes from the patriarchal religious system there. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that because I'm a, because I know people are going to say that. I'm not saying patriarchal to sound like a liberal weird. Right. I'm just seriously mean. It's a denomination that's largely been run and controlled and influenced by men. So you have to take that into account when you're looking at where theology goes off the rails a little bit. But there's my second rant. I'm sorry. That's why I do a podcast, though, so I can just talk. But
share the soapbox.
But yeah, it's crazy. I just think you hit it on the head a lot with you don't have time to step back and look at, like, why do we think about this stuff?
Because if you think about why, if you actually think about the reasoning, you'll see all of the holes that are there and you'll be like, this is ridiculous. Who would actually, what reasonable person would actually believe this way.
Right.
Like, without, they introduce it to you step by step. So you take, I've got a hair tickling me. So I've got a, so you accept this little bit, and then you take the, oh, you need it, because that whole moving the goalpost thing, another step here, I'm like, oh, that would be logical from this point to that point. That's logical. Yeah. And so you like follow this little curve off the path, and then you're like way over here.
And that's exactly right. It's based on the last step we took, this makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's, what if we base it on like our foundational thing that we're all here for, instead of based on wearing skirts, it should be skirts to the knee. And based on skirts to the knee, if someone is assaulted, then it must be because their skirt wasn't below the knee. Go ahead.
That's good. I remember when I went to camp with, I went to camp with my sister and I, and probably my brother too, because he was that age too. We went to camp with a church, and they had a home for troubled kids, the Anchor Character Training Center at the time. I don't know if it's still. And so they had girls sessions and boys sessions. They split us and then talked to us separately. And so the pastor had his girls and told us the story that this Christian girl goes with her Christian school and for a senior trip. Mm-hmm. And she she's there, this guy gets her to agree to meet with him alone. And so she goes back, and then she's going to sneak out. And so before she does, she decides to put on this something that makes her actually look like a girl.
Right.
And then he ends up assaulting her. There was bad consequences to that story, because there always are. But the whole reason that came back, when he circled back to the whole reason that happened, is because when she was sneaking out, the outfit that she chose, that's why he did what he did to her. So, okay, if you actually think about that, I think he pretty much set it up so that he could do that, because he planned that she would be alone with him so he could do whatever he wanted to do with her. But it was her fault for, yeah, that never sat well with me.
Right. Yeah, and it's such common. That's what we're seeing with the whole Me Too movement. We're seeing that's a mindset a lot of people have, even outside that world. And I hopped on the phone with a Bible college student who was like bothered by the show. And I got on the phone with him, and we talked, and it was good. And he was like, okay, I see where you're coming from. And he said, the only thing I don't get is, we're just about to hang up the phone. He said, the only thing I don't get is like, women say, oh, there's no responsibility if something happens, because, but then they wear clothes. Like he was like, said, like, he was just talking about like yoga pants and stuff. And I was like, this is going to be a long conversation. I just told him, I said, so you're basically saying at a certain point, there's no responsibility on the guy's part for what he does. If someone's in front of you naked, they're completely asking for whatever comes their way. And he's, no, I'm not saying that. I'm like, what are you saying? Because it sounds like you're just parroting the same kind of like negative toxic mindset toward it. And it's just a weird, but again, that's male culture, I think, where you start saying, oh, I think that's a signal. Like when someone wears a certain thing, that's a signal. When someone acts a certain way, that's a signal. And you can't really go off that. And so at a certain point, is everyone innocent of whatever action they do because there's an opportunity? There's no, we don't do that with any other crime. We don't do that with stealing. They left it unattended, so obviously I could steal it. That doesn't make sense.
Finders keepers.
So I am curious. So you talked a little bit about searching things out. So where do you stand now, like on the spiritual side? Where have you landed? Or you probably haven't landed. If you're like anybody, you're probably still figuring that out. Yeah. So where is that? What does that look like for you right now?
Right now, I'm exploring Messianic Judaism.
Okay.
I wasn't quite ready to give up Jesus and the whole thing, but most days I believe in God. Some days that's a struggle, because mm-hmm. I think back and like, how could God be like this? That there can't be a God that's like that.
Right.
And so still deal with some of the ideologies that I was given while I was there. But so that's where I am right now. I'm trying to find to, because of course when you leave, you don't get to take any relationships with you. So unless they come out too. I was fortunate in that my mom left with me. So I do still have that relationship. My sister is still, she's still involved in church, but we still talk. I'm still trying to find what healthy relationships look like without like people not trying to manipulate me. Yeah.
How long have you been out of the move-in?
I formally left, probably it'll be 5 years in October when my sister got married. So that's when I formally, when that happened.
That's still fresh. I mean, for me, it was like 7 years ago. So yeah, it takes a long time and you second guess a lot. But yeah. So I guess my last question that I usually try to end on this is, do you think there's a hope for reform of the IFB movement, or do you think it's something that just needs to slowly be done away with?
I would say the sooner the better. I don't think it's reformable. I think the entire premise is built on abuse and exploitation of people, specifically women and children. And so I don't think you can reform a system that is built on the premise of we have to abuse people to keep this going. I just don't think that's reformable.
And you said something before we hopped on that I was curious about. I think I've referred to it as a dying movement, and I've had other people that have referred to it. You disagree with that. I'm curious what your reasoning is or why you think it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Okay. One, there are always people that feel the need to have someone else tell them what to do. And that is an ideal place for that.
You're going to have to make a decision how much you're going to be involved in criticism of anointed leadership. You're going to have to, but the leader is out. I had the privilege Monday night to preach in my mother and dad's church. I stayed overnight and then came back in the morning. And I'm grateful that I have parents that have never lifted their hand against any man of God. And by the way, they have been going to church for 86 years. Sunday school, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. They had one pastor that committed adultery. I never knew about it. Probably for 45 years, I never knew about it, never talked about it. But someone came up to me while I was preaching in another church a few years ago and said, Mr. So-and-so had to be your pastor because he was the pastor of that church you mentioned. And I said, he was. I said, I never know what happened to him. And they said, well, he committed adultery. Well, I knew he was selling cars, but I didn't know the whole thing. My mother and dad never criticized him.
And so I think there'll always be a place like that for them. I also see the same culture I've worked in corporate America for a very long time, and I keep up on articles and stuff. I think there was an article within the last couple of years about a girl from a large corporation, one of those gig drivers corporations, that came out about sexual abuse, and they did this. It could have been talking about the same exact situation in an IFB church, the way that they victim shamed her and tried to silence her and sideline her and discredit her story. And like, who would do that? Like, I mean, and if they did, that's what you're there for anyway. So why are you complaining?
Yeah.
It's the exact same culture, and it's the same culture in some of the political circles. When you read, there was a story probably 3 or 4 years ago now in the Kansas City Star. They did a series, and it was on the culture in the state government, the state capital government circles. And they were having interns legally gagged. You cannot say anything about what goes on in this office. And of course, people were being there were people being abused, and you in order to work there, you signed a legal gag that you cannot say anything. They're like, oh, no, it's not if, you know, something wrong is happening that they can't say that. But yeah. It doesn't, when you read the thing that they sign, it's you can't say anything. Nothing that goes on inside what happens here stays here, period. Yeah. So it's the exact same culture. So I would probably, and they always tell you birds of a feather flock together. And a lot of these big churches, the leaders of these big churches, they associate with these men of power in these other two circles. Mm-hmm. And when you're seeing the same culture, you're seeing the same, that these guys palling around and supposedly they're not supposed to have anything to do with the world, but yet these are two of the most worldly places that you can find. And yet these quote unquote men of God are right there in those circles, running those same circles. Mm. So I think if it looks like a duck and it talks like a duck and it eats like a duck and smells like a duck, it's probably a duck.
Interesting. Yeah. And obviously I hope with this that we'll see like the more aggressively bad places start to shut down. And I know that there's always some good people, and I hope that those people either find their way out, or I told them the other day, I feel like the good people I know in the movement have all slowly left, or I've had a few that have tried to stay and, you know, turn things around within their own churches they have, but the movement's just not interested for whatever reason in following suit. But I appreciate you sharing that perspective and for coming on, and hopefully just sharing stories like these and conversations like these are going to help open people's eyes, whether I would hope on the leadership side, but if nothing else, the people sitting in the pew. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for checking out the show. I know you found it like a week ago, which is pretty cool, but I really appreciate you coming on and for sharing all that. It's really helpful.
My pleasure. I appreciate you providing space for people to talk about their experiences there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's definitely needed.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.